When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being.
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here again with
Scott Tobias
and Tosh Robinson.
Genevieve is out this week. She said something about taking a trip to Washington, D.C., but was vague about the details. In our last episode, we discussed the Alex Garland scripted, Danny Boyle directed 28 Days Later. This week, we'll talk about it again, but not before talking about Garland's latest film, Civil War, which he wrote and directed. Set near the conclusion of the Second American Civil War, an event seemingly just around the bend of our time, Civil War follows photojournalist Lee Smith, played by Kirsten Dunst, as she attempts to reach Washington, D.C., the behind enemy lines home of an authoritarian president played by Nick Offerman. Joining her are a reporter and fellow Reuters employee named Joel Wagner Mora, a veteran New York Times writer named Sammy Stephen McKinley Henderson, and Jesse Kaylee Spaney, an aspiring photojournalist who idolizes Lee. Their journey takes them through battlegrounds, spooky small towns, perilous backwoods stops, and other locales as they witness firsthand what happens to a nation divided against itself in the 21st century, and Jesse learns both the tricks and philosophy of the trade. We'll talk it over after the break.
Citizens of America.
People of the Florida Alliance.
You gotta move!
And the Western forces of Texas and California will be welcomed back to these United States as soon as their illegal secessionist government is deposed.
You don't know what side they're fighting for.
Someone's trying to kill us. We are trying to kill them.
Civil War.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on Civil War? I thought it was quite strong. Powerful stuff, really effective. I like this movie, but I want to hear more from you guys first.
Well, I like the part when the Union defeated the Confederacy, but I also thought some of the concessions that were made afterwards, problematic in the long term. Oh, you mean the film Civil War?
Yuck.
Yeah. I liked it too. It is a very interesting movie. It's a film that I think, obviously, it's a conversation starter to say the least. But I also think that it's very savvy and smart and bound to be misunderstood for the reasons in the way that it handles the politics end of things. I think there's another level at which Garland is trying to access or work here that is not necessarily about politics, but more about a favorite theme of his, which is sort of the general sort of collapse of society and of what happens when a country is pulled apart by the seams and people live by a different set of values. So there's a lot to think about. I think as a filmmaker, Garland continues to make strides. I think there's a lot of confidence and a lot of strong choices in the style of this movie. And then the performances are outstanding. Kirsten Dunst being foremost among those performances. So by and large, I was on board with Civil War.
I'm a little divided in how I feel about the framing of this movie, because I'm not convinced that the story that he's telling couldn't have been told, as part of a war anywhere else. You know, I'm not convinced that the American Civil War theme is necessarily strong enough to justify how provocative it is, especially right now in this political moment. But the story that he's actually telling, as opposed to the story people thought he was going to be telling, I think is terrific. Like, I really love these performances. I love the relationship between Lee and Jesse and how kind of, you know, simultaneously like prickly and maternal it is without necessarily looking like either of those things normally looks on screen. But I think above everything, you know, this movie is just beautifully shot. It's just gorgeous. And I found myself thinking just about how much this is a movie about what people see through cameras and the importance of documentation, the importance of being there to be a witness for people who can't be witnesses. And he, you know, he's trying thematically to extend that into the story that he's telling in terms of kind of being here to be a witness for everybody, regardless of your politics. And part of the way that manifests is just a really visually rich and intense movie, you know, a movie that just looks fantastic on the screen, which, you know, his movies often do. So I like overall a big recommendation. I think that this is just a really strong film. But I interviewed him about this film, and I, as a result, read a lot of other interviews with him about this film, and people keep asking him the same questions. Why is this movie so apolitical? Why don't you say anything about where the Civil War came from? Like, why isn't this more about us now? And he's very resentful of these questions. Mm-hmm. Have you guys dug into that aspect of it, that extra textual aspect of it, if you will?
Not really.
I have on the edges. I mean, I think there's kind of a wariness, and people are like, he's not really connected with that. He's got kind of comes from this sort of a centrist point of view, which I don't think is actually accurate. And of course, there's some people who are really upset with him for using footage from right wing journalists and all the. Anyway, there's just a lot of political stuff that this is already really kicking up. But I think there's such a by basically having this sort of alliance between Texas and California. You know, and by vaguing up the politics as much as possible, it doesn't vague it up entirely. I mean, I think by the end, you have an understanding of, you know, the source of the problem here. Maybe you don't want a third term president running things. But I think it allows you just, again, to focus on what he wants you to focus on, to understand in the most abstract way possible that we do live in a country that is sharply divided and and full of anger. But we don't have to necessarily get specific about how we got to where we get in this movie, other than we got there and this is what it looks like. And if you tell yourself that such a thing isn't possible, maybe you should re-examine that and think, like, what if the sort of atrocities that we've witnessed in other countries where civilizations have fallen apart and people, brothers of are against brothers, etc., that's possible here. And to see that possibility, to be confronted with that possibility, is so powerful. I think it's beyond the politics part of it.
I mean, I think, to speak to what you were saying, Tasha, I feel like the ultimate point of it, I kind of put this in my review, is like, you know what a civil war would look like in America? It would look like it would look everywhere else. You know, it is nothing special about our country in that sense. Like, when things fall apart and people turn against each other, it's always ugly in exactly the same ways. And it's, you know, I don't think this is a warning, let's not have a civil war, but it's not that either. I mean, if it is somewhat cautionary and chilling to see this play out in a familiar environment.
I mean, it is kind of that. He kind of laid out his agenda for me in our interview, and it is kind of that. Like, he wanted to avoid presenting specifics in politics because he didn't want to alienate anybody on either side. He wanted, as you say, people to look at this movie and think, man, a civil war should be bad. Maybe we can all agree that autocracy is not a great thing for us and that civil war would be unpleasant. But I think that that's kind of naive given the current state of American politics. I think a lot of people out there, as Scott said in our last segment, think they're the main character and that whatever happened, they would survive. And there's certainly a lot of guns in this country and a lot of mm-hmm. people stockpiling guns who are absolutely convinced that a civil war would, like, let them take control over their own destinies, possibly by treating everybody else in America like zombies and mowing them down without ethical concerns. So I don't know if the big picture here in terms of, you know, as I said in the first segment, when he came out with Men, he in every interview, he would say, I'm trying to start a conversation. I just want people to like discuss and debate like what this movie is about and what these themes are. But at heart, I kind of thought the themes were pretty basic and that they were, you know, that this movie was not going to start a lot of conversations that weren't already happening. And I feel a little way about that here as well. You know, that if he means for this to be the great uniter that brings people together to say, you know what, we need to all start getting along or things are going to be bad. I don't think it's going to happen. I think that the story that he is telling here, the people story, is nuanced and just really well realized and really well acted and really well written. But I don't think this movie is going to help the political situation in any way. And I just think it's kind of as like satire or observation or like commentary on our current political state. It just feels really toothless to me.
I don't know. I mean, for one, I don't know if any film really having some sort of direct impact on the culture is, it's not a great goal for a film to have, and it's not really a realistic goal for a film to have.
Well, he acknowledges that it's not realistic, that it's kind of a pipe dream. That's fair.
But it is, as a work of art, to be confronted with these types of images is powerful. You really felt something watching this movie, and so I think that's kind of all it needs to do as far as I'm concerned. As far as the toothlessness of it goes, again, I think there's a lot to chew over, so I don't know if that, I don't necessarily consider the film a satire, you know, but it does provoke and it does kind of get you to think. It's a strong film. It's not a film that's unwilling to take chances. So I don't know if I really go with describing it as toothless necessarily, even if it has to be vague about the politics part of things.
I'm just not sure that it did. You know, I keep kind of holding up mentally like Get Out as kind of an example of like how to talk about difficult issues without being preachy, but without being, you know, empty either. And I don't think that this has anything like that kind of sharpness of conceit or of observation. And that's sort of what I hoped for here, you know, and what I got instead is a really good human drama about people operating in war and about somebody dealing with trauma and exhaustion in her profession and seeing the person that's going to replace her, which I think is just kind of a fascinating place to be. I think Kaylee Spaney's performance is just so, she reminds me a lot of like Elliot Page when Elliot Page first started out in film. There's kind of a combination of physical softness and internal hardness, like fierceness, that I think is really interesting in her performance here and in Priscilla. I hope she has a huge career ahead of her, but I think her arc is really interesting here.
Yeah, and both of those emphasize just how tiny a person she is too.
Yeah,
they're not shying away from that. And she's also the star of, as we mentioned before, the new Alien film, which I suspect will also make good use of that. So like her being 5'1" is kind of its own special effect at times in a way.
Yeah, she seems very fragile, and at the same time, like she's got the equivalent of short man syndrome. You know, she's not going to let being tiny get in the way. She's going to be a little mouse that roared.
And she also, you know, Jesse has the strength of vision to shoot on film rather than on DV. So in that sense.
So she's your hero.
She's got it all over Danny Boyle. Yeah. I love that little touch that she's got this analog thing going where she's shooting on film and they're looking at frames. It's
portable dark room or whatever.
Oh, that was cool as hell.
I looked up it. And her camera, by the way, was like the, like, was very popular Nikon model, strangely long lived, like all throughout the 80s. You can get them, you can still get them for like $150 used if you want to go out in the field yourself.
He's become quite the shutter bug.
Well, a little bit. Enough of the shutter bug to know that it is insane not to use a digital camera in that situation if you have one available to you.
That's fair, but I mean, the scene where they compare cameras is kind of one of my favorite quiet moments in a movie, with a bunch of very resonant quiet moments to kind of balance out the terrifying ones. But also, it became so much more resonant for me later in the movie when we see Lee sitting alone looking at a picture that she took on her digital camera and consciously making the decision to delete it. You know, it depicts something that she doesn't want to see, that she doesn't want to revisit, that she doesn't want to risk other people seeing, that she decides for whatever reason she decides. And this, honestly, I feel like could be much more of a conversation piece. For whatever reason she decides, this image shouldn't be in the world. It's not that it feels opaque. It's that it feels ambiguous because there are a lot of different ways you can interpret that. All of them, you know, heavy and sad and meaningful and beautiful. But her decision to like obliterate this picture, this image that she's taken, it's just something that you know Kaylee Spaney's character wouldn't have really been able to do, because you could cut the negative out of the strip and throw it away, I guess. But there's just much less of a sense there of just making something not exist in the world anymore, you know?
Yeah, what are the standout scenes for you? Because it's an episodic film. It brought to mind, we were talking about Afterwards, like easily could have paired it with Apocalypse Now in the sense that it is kind of it's a journey that goes from episode to episode and kind of heads into the heart of darkness. But what were the standout scenes for you? I really thought early on it kind of set a tone for how chilling it would be with that stop at the gas station. Not to spoil into too many details, but that is rough stuff.
Yeah, the gas station and a sequence involving Jesse Plemons, who is playing kind of yet another Jesse Plemons character. I mean, you could easily see that being the same character that he plays in, say, Breaking Bad or The Game, like equally. Yeah.
Dead-eyed white nationalist.
Just the performance that he brings to so many things, that's just a kind of like belligerent blankness. The, you know, the humorless equivalent of, are you laughing at me? He's so scary. He's always scary when he wants to be scary, and yet hilarious when he wants to be hilarious.
He gives you that, how could this be profitable for Frito-Lay kind of look. He gives you that look.
Pretty much exactly that. And it's like, as soon as you see him show up, you're like, oh God.
Yes.
Things are about to get really bad.
The glasses in this are so good too. Just like that's just like one little bit of costume, you know, one little detail in the scene that just kind of kicks it up a notch, is those kind of red glasses that he wears. Fantastic stuff.
I was talking to Scott after the screen, is like how like 16 years ago or whenever Friday Night Lights was on, I was like, look at that sweet boy playing sweet boy characters. He's just going to play sweet boys the rest of his life. And that's has not been born out.
No. Watching the film, Apocalypse Now came to mind immediately because it is a journey into the heart of darkness. And because, you know, this journey allows you to have these little episodes that can be distinct and give you different, you know, and often kind of strange visions of this country as it's falling apart. You know, and of course, one of the main sequences, one of the best sequences of the film, in my view, is when they visit a town that seems utterly unspoiled by what has happened. We discover, of course, that they're highly aware and protecting this little idyll that they've built in the middle of chaos. But the strangeness of that scene is just so, the tonal shift the film takes at that moment is so striking. And I mean, this film is just, you know, really does have a good three or four sequences like that to just feel like so sharp, these just standalone sequences that, you know, when you, if you're thinking about, you know, sometimes I think about scenes and like, I'm going to file that away. You know, there's a poll that I do for our listener, Mike D'Angelo. You know, he has a scene of the year category, and it's like, sometimes I'll tuck certain scenes in my brain, just think that's going to come up later. And like, this has got like three of those. So kudos to him for that. But though I will also say, if I'm going to compare this film to Apocalypse Now, is that I think it could actually be a little weirder. You know, you think about Apocalypse Now and it's just like some of the things that they encounter are so inspired and strange and surreal. And I think this film doesn't, only in that small town sequence, I think, does the film quite go that far in surprising you in the way that Coppola's film does, but otherwise effective in similar ways.
That scene is kind of the equivalent of the least love Apocalypse Now scene, though. It is their French plantation in a way.
Yeah.
Right. So wait, what are your three, Scott? The small town, the gas station, and Jesse Plemons or something
That's
else?
That's right. Those would be the three, I think.
I'm not to give anything away, but not the finale. I found the finale really striking, and
that's good too. Really good ending too. Like the interview that he gets with the president is very, very well done. Like that is you know, highly effective.
The action sequence that happens toward the end, again, to kind of gloss over exactly what that is, I think is shot in a really compelling way. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a lot was said in the years after the September 11th attacks about how directors were borrowing imagery from real life to show what like disaster would look like on film, and it produced a lot of squeamishness and discomfort. Mm-hmm. Here, it seems like Garland is just very much taking footage of war reporters embedded, you know, with digital cameras among troops in Afghanistan or Iraq. And like, it has that feel. It has a very verisimilitude, like running through the streets kind of feel. So I thought that whole sequence was pretty incredible. But for me, the standout moment in the movie, apart from Lee deleting the photo, which just I found really, really striking, is when they're driving through a forest fire. It's a very quiet moment that actually recalled for me some of the driving sequences in Children of Men, you know, with the fire all around them and sparks flying through the air and landing on the windshield. It's really visually beautiful. And it's also just sort of this strange moment of calm where everything is being destroyed around them. Everything is coming apart in what feels like a big resonant, you know, thematic moment for the movie. And yet it's sort of peaceful because there are no other people there. You know, it's the natural world disintegrating as opposed to the human world. And it almost feels like peace as a result. And I just think that that's one of the both one of the most daring things in the movie and one of the most visually beautiful.
Yeah, no, it's real good. And another like small moment too, I think, is right from the start is the suicide bombing as well of someone running into a crowd. And Lee immediately recognizing that there's going to be an explosion and kind of, you know, shielding Jesse and kind of getting out of the way of it. But just like that moment of just like public disaster again, I mean, if you're talking about taking from realities that we've seen elsewhere through war reporting and kind of transporting it into the street, onto the streets of America, I think that's kind of a chilling introduction to all of that.
Yeah, that's really strong. In a, you know, sort of a selfish way, though, I also just got a lot out of the sequence where the reporters are all sitting around together. There's a lot of camaraderie there as they discuss like where they've been and where they're going, like what their next assignments are. There's that sort of the sense that you always get with a group of journalists of we're all in this together and we understand each other in a way probably nobody else can, but we're also all in competition and we've got a sharp dividing line between all the things we share as members of this profession and all the things we have to keep close to our vest. I really liked how that whole sequence played out. Even if Stephen McKinley Henderson does just get ruthlessly roasted by his compatriots in the rudest possible ways.
I love him, though.
I know. Is there anyone that makes you happier when they show up in a movie than Stephen McKinley Henderson?
He's so good.
He can be in everything as far as I'm concerned. He's endlessly fun.
Another detail, you know, if you're talking about that scene, another detail I really liked was the desk clerk telling Lee that, you know, the elevator might get stuck, you know, because of the power outages. And it's just kind of like the way it's said and the way everything is sort of processed is like, yep, this is just the way the hotel operates now. You know, you just get stuck on the elevator because all of this war that's happening around us could, you know, cut the power out. So even if you're on the 10th floor, you may have to take the stairs. I think that's, again, it's good writing, and it's a director kind of really thinking through, you know, the world of the film as thoroughly as possible.
Well, there's still more to talk about, and I'm sure we will. And I hope we get some feedback on this film, because it's a film I think we'd like to, you know, I think our readers like to talk over with us. We'll be back after the break, though, to talk about how it connects to 28 Days Later.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Help you folks? Just looking for gas. Got a look at the fuel permit?
No, we're actually just passing through.
Can't help, sir.
Sir, if we pay.
I was never gonna give it free.
Over the odds.
What's over the odds?
300. For half a tank and two cans?
300 buys you a sandwich. We got ham or cheese?
300 Canadian.
Okay.
Now it's time for connections, where we bring our two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. I mean, the most obvious one here is just touring a country that's falling apart. So maybe we should talk about the road trip element of this to start things off. Both are journeys through parts of the country that you don't normally see. Begin in an urban spot and then go to a rural spot, and I'll let everyone else take it from there.
I mean, there's a fair bit of here we have a moment of like absolute pants wetting, we're about to die terror. And then, you know, here we have the next day when we're sitting and having a picnic. That back and forth of being in a war zone and finding these little pockets of peace, these little pastoral experiences where maybe everything is brighter and more resonant because you almost died and then you didn't. But the back and forth rhythm I found very familiar.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, the rhythm is actually quite satisfying because, you know, with 28 days later, you have it opens quiet. I mean, it opens with we don't know what's going on, and we get just an empty hospital and empty streets and all these places that, of course, we expect to be extremely populated, it being a city, being emptied out, and then rhythmically you can then cut to a lot of freneticism later. And I think that's effective in different ways. Having these little pockets in place in Civil War just gives a nice variance. And I think that's, you know, when we want to talk about the whole road tripping aspect of both of these movies, that's what the structure kind of allows. I mean, when you talk about a road movie in general, road movies give you a sense of the landscape, but they also give filmmakers a tremendous amount of latitude to explore different tones, different types of scenes, different episodes, you know, and there's a looseness to them and a sense of possibility and surprise that I think Garland seizes on quite well in both films by setting you on the road and having both you as an audience member and these characters make all these, you know, discoveries. It's a good narrative strategy for both of these films.
And not just variety, but inequity. You know, the travel from places in Civil War where there are pitched battles going on between sides and places that seem completely untouched. The back and forth in 28 Days Later between going through a tunnel full of infected that are just actively trying to eat your face versus here's a completely untouched shopping center that's absolutely full of like fresh, bright goods. The sense that things are very different just down the road, I think, is maybe just always sort of a resonant theme for road movies, because it kind of reminds you that you probably, you know, unless you're like in the military or a traveling salesperson or like a retiree with a ton of money or something, you probably spend a lot of your life in more or less one place, mm-hmm. You know, the place where you live, the place where you've put down roots. And being reminded that maybe just up the road, people are living radically different lives from you, I think is just an interesting one to kind of like plug into the theme of a movie.
And it's a reminder, too, that in these specific situations, as far as people living differently up the road from you, I mean, they've been forced to. I mean, like the entire civilization's been kind of thrown up in the air, and people have had to kind of remake things on the fly and, you know, make up their own rules in a way. And so you do kind of end up in a lot of different situations. You can end up in a small town where everyone is pretending like everything is normal, even though there are snipers, you know, on the roofs, as there is in Civil War. Or you can end up in 28 Days Later, where in the third act, where it's like, you know, you have people who are living with a certain amount of safety and stability and modernity, I guess, with the hot water. But, you know, there's another side to that as well. So, yeah, I just appreciate it. I mean, I think, you know, the risk with any road movie is some episodes working better than others. There can be a certain slackness in pacing, but that's not a problem with either one of these movies. And I think it just allows Garland to be as surprising as possible, as spontaneous as possible, as conceptually daring as possible within the conceit of these two movies.
Yeah, I think there's also just sort of an interesting tension. You know, I'm thinking of the almost back-to-back sequences in 28 Days Later, where they have a picnic, where they're, you know, sharing food, and Jim is like eating with his mouth open to gross his companions out, and they kind of have everything they need in that moment. And the moment where he walks into the gas station and, you know, is told, we've got everything we need. You don't need to go in there. You're just going to get yourself in trouble. And he refuses to listen. And then he confronts and has to kill a small infected child who tries mm-hmm. to murder him. And like, there's no good coming out of that. You know, he does what he has to do to survive, but he comes away feeling, you know, sick and compromised. He, much like Brendan Gleeson, didn't have to kick that shed. He did not have to like go in that space. You know, he could have walked away from that situation and never even seen it, never been aware of it. It was like one wall away from him completely avoiding that experience. And he made a bad choice. And I think that, again, that kind of narrative irony of, you did something you didn't need to do, and therefore something bad happened that didn't need to happen, is, you know, the kind of thing that can hang very heavily over a movie, you know, in good and provocative and emotional ways, but still, you know, a dreadful, heavy, depressing, meaningful ways.
I think there's kind of a through line. You can get a little broad with it, I guess, but there's interest in like decay and collapse of organizations is kind of a through line through Alex Garland's career. So let's in terms of screenwriting, at least these bookend it. Look, so how does the depiction of things falling apart in 28 Days Later compare to how things fall apart in Civil War?
I mean, the beautiful thing is that, I mean, he gives you the very beginning, the inciting incident in 28 Days Later, but he really doesn't pick up the action in either film until things have collapsed already, you know, so we don't really get a breakdown of like all of the institutions failing and people kind of going off on their own and, you know, making whatever moral decisions they're going to make without the presence of any kind of order. He kind of disposes with all that and then throws us into the situation where we're learning it all on the fly. And, you know, it makes it, I think that's kind of an exciting approach.
I think the really important difference between these two worlds in terms of collapse is that it's unclear whether there's Pepsi after the apocalypse in Civil War, whereas it's really, really clear that you can get all the Pepsi you want in 28 Days Later. Did that stand out for you guys as much as it did for me?
The Pepsi? I'm always interested in like post-apocalyptic product placement because like there's a one Terminator movie with Christian Bale that has like this whole scene set at a 7-Eleven. And I guess it's something to say that like our business is so strong, it's going to survive a robot apocalypse, but I'm not sure how that works in terms of like being effective marketing.
All of our stockholders are zombies now. I don't know what's going to. I don't know whether they're going to benefit from Pepsi getting a spike. Plus, no one's paying for it anymore. There's just Pepsi all over the floor.
Yeah, it's just it's lying around everywhere you look. It's you know, to the point where you can turn it into a weapon if you need to.
I do appreciate the shout out to Tango, which is I remember being a very delicious orange soda that I drank quite a bit when I was in England.
It did kind of make me laugh though, because at this point I'm collecting things that happen in movies where people are offered a Pepsi in a very pointed product placement way and refuse it. Because we kind of had that happen back to back in True Detective season 4 and in Madam Web, of all things. So maybe like people being offered Pepsi and not drinking it apparently like went all the way back to the 90s. And I just wasn't aware of it. I just like to think of, you know, Pepsi's marketing board somewhere is saying, how can we further convey that nobody likes our product, but you don't have any choice after everything's fallen apart?
Now, to get back to the collapse of civilization, which I understand Pepsi is related to that in some way, but I think one of the important connections between the two films is that in both scenarios we get to a point where humans are killing other humans, and that becomes kind of the focus, even pointedly when we're dealing with zombified versions of humans, and when we're not, and when we're at the compound at the end of 28 days later, and there's enough suspicion and tension between parties that people kill each other that way. But the fascinating part is like to think about what we're capable of as a species when the rules don't apply anymore, and how quickly that can happen. I mean, obviously we're picking up later in both of these films, and the scenarios are a little bit different in that in 28 days later people have turned, but I think there is, even in 28 days later, a very strong emphasis on the humanity of even the zombies and then here, a situation like that gas station scene, you know, to have to be in that spot that they're in, where they have half a tank of gas, they don't know when they're gonna get gas again, they have to look to the people who are sort of with guns who are mining the gas station, thinking like, are we going to be able to negotiate with them? What is this situation going to bring? I mean, it's an incredible thing to have to think about as a person living in America who is used to pulling into any gas station in the country, filling up and then leaving. And now we're in a situation where we're in a recognizable version of America in which the tensions that are boiling under the surface right now are on the surface, and no rules apply, and people have guns, and this is what we're dealing with, and it's very chilling to consider, and it's something that I think is a pretty clear obsession of Alex Garland's.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that across these two movies, you have two different groups of people who, faced with crisis, cannot just hunker down and stay where they are, and for very different reasons. You know, the group in 28 Days Later has hope. They're convinced that things might be better someplace else. The group in Civil War is convinced that they have a job to do. You know, they have a story that they want to tell, and it's important to them that they tell it because they see the window for that story rapidly closing. Man, one of the things I think Civil War captures in a really interesting way is how closely in journalism, like, an altruistic desire to get the truth out to people and to document reality for the future, how easily that can fold into, like, ego. You know, there's a thread with our little journalistic protagonist group of, but I want to be the one to do it, you know, for my outlet, for history, but also just, you know, for me personally and my reputation. There's a sense that they are trying to preserve something and make sure that it's on the record, make sure that it's documented and documented correctly. But they're also, you know, making sure that other journalists don't have the opportunity to get to it first. And that kind of competitive edge, I think, is interesting. But the difference between we have to cross the country in order to not die and we're choosing to cross the country in order to get this story, I think, is an interesting one that does kind of change the tenor of these movies, where in both cases, it would certainly be safer and maybe a lot more sensible for people to just stay put. There's maybe not a ton of hope in Alex Garland movies, but both groups in this pairing do hope for something. They are driven to seek out something like better than what they have on hand. And I think that that's something that he explores a lot in his films, sometimes in a malign sort of way. You know, the character at the heart of Ex Machina, who's trying to make a better world for himself specifically, it's not a heroic impulse and it's not a positive one. But, you know, exploring that that hunger for something better, boy, it certainly comes up a lot in The Beach, for instance. I think the kind of twin drive for something better in maybe a story like The Beach and the drive to know, to understand what's actually going on in Men and Annihilation, I think is maybe another like big Garland connector.
I was about to say, Keith, I think I've now, just based on this conversation, convinced that I'm going to write about it for us now. Just like kind of go back and look at The Beach as kind of like this moment for where Garland, because I remember really mostly enjoying the novel, save for kind of the final act, and I think the film had the same sort of issues, but it's been so long, and again, you know, looking at Garland in 2024, when now he has so many more films under his belt, you know, he's directing, he's showing, you know, he's developed so much his own style as an actual filmmaker, that kind of seeing the origins of that in The Beach or in 28 Days Later is kind of interesting, because there's all kinds of through lines and connectors and things that you like to make with auteurs that you couldn't really make at the time.
I thought The Beach was really, really interesting in its day. And, you know, both the movie and the book, which is that the book is basically, it reads like one of those stories that somebody writes because they want to make the movie version and know it's going to be, you know, it's such a direct translation of the book to the screen. But I thought that movie was really interesting, both stylistically in terms of Danny Boyle just like playing around with visual elements, but in terms of the tensions that underwrite it, you know, the desire to get someplace pristine and unspoiled while being one of the people that's making it stop being pristine and unspoiled, like the desire to have something that nobody else has, but to keep other people from having it because they're having it will spoil your having it. I think that there's a lot of very smart stuff going on in that movie and that it comes through a couple of really interesting actors who we've seen do a ton of stuff since that's maybe like more sophisticated or more thorough and more them. You know, it maybe feels like a baby project for writer, director, and the two leads. But I just remember thinking it was a really interesting project in its day. I've got a real fond spot for it. But granted, I haven't revisited it since pretty closely after it came out.
Man, that sounds like a your next picture show recommendations you tucked into connections here.
I guess that's true. Although, again, it's been quite a while since I've seen it. I don't know if it'll hold up.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Well, to veer us back to connections between these two movies we're discussing, one of the things that really struck me is how similar the character dynamics are. You know, you've got a kind of tough-as-nails older woman who takes a kind of like soft and naive, but still very tough in her own right, like younger woman under her wing. You've got the guy who's maybe a little bit of a doofus, who's kind of a hanger-on that's a little bit external to their relationship, but kind of turns out to be a little bit of the emotional heart of the story. And then you've got a fourth dude who you lose along the way, you know, who's, you know, I was thinking of that as actually being Selena's original companion.
Oh, I thought you were thinking of Brendan Gleeson.
But yeah, now that I think about it, you know, Brendan Gleeson's character is more of a parallel because, you know, you've got like two very big, bearish, kind of like jovial, but kind of like sad under the surface men who kind of have anger issues and kind of to some degree, like are the father figure of the group, you know, the elder statesman of the group, and both get killed. So, yeah, you know, the degree to which 28 Days Later kind of seems like a practice run for that dynamic. Selena and Hannah don't feel as nearly as developed as characters and individuals as Lee and Jesse do. But I do see some of the same dynamics there and some of the same sort of broad archetypes at work in all of these characters. And we don't see Joel in Civil War like suddenly rip off his shirt and go running commando style around, like saving the day for everybody in DC.
No. But now I think about it, too, in terms of, again, these character parallels, which are all very good. One element of Stephen McKinley Henderson and Brendan Gleeson, you know, and the sacrifices that they have to make is like, I think there's a paternal warmth and kind of guidance that they bring to the table, a wisdom that is both, you know, essential to these characters and important to them and is a grounding force for them, but also something that they have to learn to live without at a certain point. You know, I guess that's a sort of a spoiler alert for both films, but like, I think they serve the same kind of narrative function in that sense of just like, they have, you know, all of these other characters who are younger than they are, they're the future. They have to take what they can from the guidance that they have been given by these older gentlemen and kind of carry that forward into this new remade society.
They also both end up saving everybody by driving cars like absolute maniacs.
That's true. Boy, what again, a nice little like detail in 28 Days Later is, speaking of the cars, when they end up in the compound in the third act and peer out the window and the soldiers are kind of like, you know, doing donuts and stuff in the car. It's so casually cruel given all that has occurred in that car and all the significance of that. It's kind of almost the first moment where it's like, maybe this is not going to be a good situation for them. Yeah, don't know about these guys. Yahoos, these militaristic yahoos.
I don't know about these guys. I mean,
the worries about militaristic yahoos, there's kind of a thread through both of these movies that's just a bit of distrust of the military. And by the end of Civil War, you know, the group that the journalists get embedded with, especially the black woman at their lead, seem like competent and principled people who have fought their way across the country to end a dictatorship. You know, they're not villains the way the soldiers are in 28 Days Later. But there's unquestionably a sense in both movies of, you know, our civilian characters are outside of this machine. And the machine consists of people who have trained together, who have worked together, who know and trust each other, who are, you know, comfortable with weapons and comfortable with violence and know what to do in a crisis. And our protagonists are outside of all of that and kind of have to become, you know, dependents on and adherents to and witnesses of the things that the military groups do, just, you know, knowing that they don't have much power in that environment. And that sort of, you know, a queasy discomfort of like living alongside people who are comfortable with guns, I think is a clear attitude in both of these movies. You know, even if one of them ends up turning a little military group into villains and one ends up turning them into heroes.
I was really struck by the scene early on, fairly early on in Civil War, where Joel kind of yucks it up with the soldiers that he's just seen. You know, I guess probably nothing they've done is outside the rules of engagement. Well, perhaps it is, but these are people who commit some pretty strong acts of violence. Let's put it that way. And that he can be so casual with him. I was unsure if this was a matter of kind of, you know, him kind of fitting in to get the story better, or if his comfort with them was really genuine, if he actually sided with their cause, you know, even though he's a journalist. It's an interesting moment. What did you guys make of that?
I'm going to not answer that question and then maybe leave it to Scott to discuss and kind of zoom out a little bit. I think Joel's character in the movie, like in a not too distant past, maybe the past of 2002 and 28 Days Later, like Joel would have been our hero, our point of view character. And instead, he's just kind of a supplementary edge figure in all of this, but kind of almost off screen most of the time. You can see him having a really resonant emotional arc. And it starts with being the kind of person who seems to just be a thrill seeker, like seems to want to throw himself onto this road trip and into this very unlikely goal, kind of because he thinks it's going to be exciting. Like you see him inviting Jesse along for the trip, probably because on some level he wants to get into her pants. And you see him facing danger with just kind of a woo kind of excitement. And then you see what it takes to make him break down and like kind of puncture the shell of immortality that he's felt around himself. And like, I don't need to see the version of this film that focuses entirely on him instead, but I think it's really interesting how Civil War suggests that he's having his entire own movie in the background of this other movie that's going on around him.
I mean, I think we already touched on a little bit the cynicism about humanity's future. I think there is that seed of hope that is planted in both of these films. I mean, we talked about the various possible endings for 28 Days Later that it would have made it seem a little less hopeful. But the version we got is the most hopeful version. And I think the hope ends up lying in people who are able to maintain their integrity, maintain their humanity. Those are gonna kind of be the sort of beacons of light who could potentially revive, you know, the best piece of us as humans, and I don't really feel like who knows how America might remake itself in the wake of the events in Civil War, but I think what ultimately happens at the end is certainly an ending of something and a beginning of something else. And at least we have some of the survivors, the people that we've been following that do make it are people that we can trust will make the world a better place by being in it. So there's that sliver of hope anyway.
Or at least being the people that would stand up to the kind of thing that, you know, it's implied rather than mostly stated has happened in America. I mean, I agree. I think that these movies are both very cynical about humanity and very hopeful about there being a way forward, about there being possibility. Yeah. I think it's really interesting that in 28 Days Later, the protagonist group goes from this like very like pastoral experience as just the foursome of them like on this road trip towards hope, to being in and among military people and fearing for their lives and fearing for their bodily sanctity. And yet at the end, they're so happy to be flagging down a military jet. You know, they have not given up on the idea of humanity, even though they're back to just them and a pastoral setting where they really kind of seem to have everything they need. They're still looking to connect with other people. They're still looking forward to some kind of future with other people. You know, maybe that's naivete, but it seems significant that the movie doesn't end with, we've come to this place where only we live and therefore we're happy. I think the zombies dying out is in its way very similar thematically to what happens at the end of Civil War. And, you know, as you say, there's a sort of sense of, we don't know what the future's going to hold, and whatever it holds, it's probably going to have like horrible, murderous yahoos still in it because that's the way people are. But we're still going to hold on to hope, you know, for whatever reason. I think Alex Garland might be an idealist under the cynicism, and, you know, good for him.
Why don't we also end on an upbeat note and leave it there. Although I think there's a lot more to say about this pairing if people would like to write in. 28 Days Later is kind of hard to find, honestly. I believe it's there's a whole rights issue with it. I believe that Andrew McDonald, who's the producer who worked with Danny Boyle and Alex Garland on this and worked with Boyle in a bunch of movies, I believe he has purchased the rights back ahead of 28 Years Later, which is apparently going to happen. But currently it's in a kind of limbo. I watched it on DVD. I think I bought a DVD a year or so ago just because I knew I wanted to watch it again. It was the only way to do it. But Tasha, you had some luck finding a streaming version of it, right?
Yeah, there's a streaming version of it, a free streaming version of it on Sling TV, which you can find online at sling.tv, I believe. With the caveat that, you know, it's your basic free with ads kind of streaming service. It's the first streaming service I've ever seen where, you know, when we paused the movie, we noticed that this hour and 50 minutes long movie was being listed as a 2 hour and 40 minute movie on the site, because that's how much time we were giving over to ads.
No.
And, you know, we sat down and did the math, and this is technically not any different from what, you know, broadcast TV, like the percentage of broadcast TV that's ads, but actually seeing that number in front of you and realizing like, oh, 50 minutes of this experience is going to be ads was pretty draining. I felt like I was facing the zombie apocalypse without like a trusty Pepsi in my hand. But hey, it's free. You get what you pay for.
And Civil War is not free, but it is currently in theaters. It's very accessible. so, you know, go see that, I guess. We'll be right back with your next picture show. Finally, it's time to recommend a film or film-related item that complements this set of episodes. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it will put some interesting choices on your radar. There's something we've kind of been dancing around a little bit that was a pretty obvious Your Next Picture Show candidate. I think Scott has some words about. Scott, what is Your Next Picture Show, in case our listeners have not guessed already?
another film I haven't seen since it came out, but I remember I was quite fond of the sequel to 28 Days Later, which is 28 Weeks Later, directed by Juan Carlos Fresnadillo, who had done this film Intacto that I had really loved at the time, and brought a lot of skill to this movie. 28 Weeks Later kind of takes place at a moment when society is trying to be rebuilt under U.S. guidance, but they're trying to sort of repopulate Britain under the thought that this is not going to be a problem anymore. It is a problem. It's a film that it is. I think you would probably say it's a little bit slicker than 28 Days Later, but I'm reading my own review of the film, and I do say that the whole movie looks like it was filtered through a rugby player's undergarments, so it does have that kind of roughness to it, and it's a film that's got some actors who would sort of emerge on the scene in a big way later on. It has Jeremy Renner, it has Rose Byrne. It's got Robert Carlyle is in this film, and it's got and as children, it's got the two most British named child actors together, Macintosh Muggleton and Imogen Poots are both in this film. I think it's a worthy sequel, and it's kind of one I want to revisit now that we've revisited the Boyle film, because I remember it being. Taking the bold stand that it was an improvement on the first one. I'm not sure if that would be a true statement, but I do think I do feel pretty confident that it was kind of a worthy follow up.
Yeah, I remember liking it. How about you, Tasha?
I remember liking it. I don't remember thinking it was as stylish. I am severely doubting the experiences of a past Tasha. I would have revisited this for this podcast as well if I was not having a problem with my account that I would have used to watch it. But I do plan on revisiting it pretty soon. I'm curious how it holds up.
Well, it's actually similar, kind of hard to find, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly. We can all find it through dubious sources together.
No, I actually think it's not nearly as difficult to find. I'm pretty sure it was streaming on Hulu and rentable.
Oh, okay. I think it's the Blu-ray is a coveted item. If you're on reddit.com our Blu-ray collectors or boutique Blu-ray, then you will know these things. That is it for this edition of The Next Picture Show. We'll be back next week with another set of episodes. Scott, do you want to tell us about our next pairing?
Luca Guadagnino's new movie Challengers is a sparky, playful drama that steps on genre boundaries like a tennis player stepping on the baseline while serving. If you don't immediately know what that means, you might want to bone up on tennis rules before watching the latest film from the director of Call Me By Your Name and Bones and All. It's an intense sports drama about a teen prodigy turned coach, played by Zendaya, and the rivalry between husband and coachee, played by West Side Story's Mike Feist, and her ex and on-again, off-again flame, played by The Crown's Josh O'Connor. The loose friendship and complicated dynamics between these three players, and the way their relationship veers in and out of a threesome romance, reminded us of Alfonso Cuarón's 2001 breakout movie, Y Tu Mama Tambien, about two teenage boys who are longtime friends and the emotionally fraught road trip they take with a young woman they meet at a wedding. So our next double feature will be about two kinds of three ways as we compare Challengers and Y Tu Mama Tambien.
For now, we welcome your feedback on 28 Days Later, Civil War, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. Email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net or leave us a voicemail at 773-234-9730. Before we close out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Tasha?
I am the film and streaming editor over at polygon.com, where you can find my review of Civil War, the interview that I did with Alex Garland, where he tells you what he wants people to get out of this movie, and a separate piece that I did from that interview about how he got the forest fire sequence, which I thought was super cool. He told me a story about that scene that I thought was just neat. I can be found on Blue Sky at Tasha Robinson, and pretty much don't exist on other social media. Scott, what about you?
Well, I want to give a quick shout out to Tasha just generally, because as you were saying, what you had going as far as Civil War and Alex Garland goes, I think when you like something, you know, you always find exciting ways to sort of dig deeper into them. And I think it's gratifying for us as readers and film lovers to, you know, experience
goodness,
that.
Scott, so, thank you so much. I take back 10% of the nasty things that I've said about your film taste over the years.
There's so much that left of that 90%. So you can find me on Blue Sky at Scott Tobias. I'm posting less. I'm trying to get off as much as possible. X, but I'm there at Scott_Tobias. You can find my work primarily at The Reveal, the newsletter that I write with Keith Phipps. That's thereveal.substack.com. And you can also find my work in New York Times, Vulture, Guardian, and other fine publications. Keith, what about you?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find me at thereveal.substack.com, where, you know, we write about all kinds of stuff. So, you know, if you enjoy this podcast, you would enjoy that, I believe. But you can also find my work at places like Vulture, The Ringer, TV Guide, and you can find me on Blue Sky primarily at KFIPS3000. I'm on other sites too, KFIPS3000, but not so much X. I am off there because, you know, I'm done. And our absent co-host, Genevieve Kosky, is the TV editor at Vulture. You can find her. She is on Blue Sky occasionally at Genevieve Kosky, where you can check out her antics there, right?
Antics? Very few antics.
No antics.
None of antics.
She's there in the sense that she has a username.
We're awaiting antics, Genevieve. Come on.
But we're excited. We're excited to see what she's going to do.
It's going to be nuts. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show at nextpictureshow.net and on Blue Sky at The Next Picture Show. Get bonus content and open discussion at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. And as always, we appreciate your rating and reviews on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to the show. Thanks to Dan the Baked Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting and Family of Podcast. Please tune in next time.